Next hour, psychic Joseph Jacobs joins us, but David Weintraub is with us now. He's the astronomer, and his book is called Life on Mars. His website is linked up at coasttocoastam.com. We'll be back and chat more with him. Take your phone calls and also the question, would you take a one-way trip to Mars and just stay there? I wouldn't go. As exciting as it might seem, I like planet Earth a little too much. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. David Weintraub with us, of course. His book is called Life on Mars, What to Know Before We Go. David, do you think we should go to Mars with astronauts?
At the moment, my answer is no, I don't think we should go. I think that because there is some possibility that life already exists on Mars, I think we should study Mars without human presence on Mars for longer until we can find out for certain, or at least to a very, very high degree of certainty, whether life does or does not exist on Mars. And if Mars appears to be sterile, then by all means, let's go colonize Mars. But if Mars is already home to Martians, even if it's microscopic Martians, microbes living underground, then I think we have some very, very serious ethical questions to ponder. Do we have the right to take over another world that already is full of life, that our presence on Mars could in fact contaminate Mars and destroy the life that's already there? I think those are important questions.
Robert Zubrin from the Mars Society thinks we need to go and terraform Mars first. I don't know how long that would take. But he said it's conceivable that we could create an atmosphere. What do you think?
I think he's right. We don't know how to do it, though there are people working on those ideas. But at least in concept, it is possible over hundreds, thousands, millions of years that we could change the atmosphere of Mars so that the atmosphere was thicker and warmer. We could bring the water to the surface and possibly make Mars an Earth-like planet in every way. But my concern isn't whether that's doable or not. My concern is whether we should do it, because if there are already Martians on Mars, perhaps it belongs to them.
And it's a remarkable feat. What about other countries, David? Are they going to go at it?
At the moment, the Mars One group is a Dutch group. So already the answer is yes. There is also a group, the country of the United Arab Emirates has announced that they plan to build a city on Mars by 2117.
Wow.
At the moment, they don't have a viable space program, but they have cash. So is there an international competition to go to Mars? Yes.
Stephen Hawking, the late physicist, said that we should get our act together and be ready to leave this planet. What do you think of that?
I think we should get our act together and save this planet. I think that human nature is to explore, and I think exploring is what keeps civilizations bright and vibrant and energetic. So exploring beyond the Earth is something we ought to continue to work to do. But I think the more compelling thing for us to do right now is to stop destroying the Earth, worrying about global warming, worrying about plastics contaminating the ocean. There are a lot of things we could be doing to try to make sure that we don't destroy this planet. But if we destroy this planet, we ought to have another place to live. That's Elon Musk's motivation, that he thinks we're going to destroy this planet, so we ought to become a multi-planet species and have another place to go. But if we destroy this one, we'd probably destroy the next one, too. So maybe we ought to develop some good habits right here at home.
What if the opposite has happened already, David? And what if the Martians destroyed their planet and came here?
I guess anything is possible, but I think any Martian life that, if any Martian life once existed, it was microscopic Martian life. There's no evidence at all that anything significant ever existed on Mars in terms of advanced life forms. It is possible that life existed on Mars and an asteroid hit Mars and a piece of Mars spun off and flew to the Earth. And through a process that science fiction writers call panspermia,
right,
life on Earth could have been seeded by pre-existing life on Mars, but I don't think Martian life escaped Mars because they were destroying that planet. I think the planet was just a different environment from the Earth and has changed in ways that are different from how the Earth has changed.
All right, welcome to Coast. Let's go to the calls now. And my first question to everybody is, would you take a one-way trip to Mars and then go with your question? Let's go to Tom to start in the Bronx. Go ahead, Tom, would you?
No, I'm afraid not. I don't. I dislike airplanes or dirigibles or whatever. But I like to say, I wonder if Mars, in the center of Mars, whether they that planet may have lost the hot spot that feeds like volcanoes on Earth and all. I wonder if that was that acts like the boiler for Earth.
That's a good question. Mars is a smaller planet than the Earth, and because it's smaller, it has a harder time holding its heat. So Mars probably has cooled off more than the Earth has cooled off, and as a result, the processes that drive volcanic activity on the Earth and drive plate tectonics on the Earth, those processes have weakened or perhaps stopped completely on Mars. So inside Mars, it is probably colder than inside the Earth.
Inside the center of the planet Earth, David, it's a molten core right now. What's prohibiting our ocean waters of seeping all the way through and extinguishing that? Is that conceivable?
No. The water is a very light molecule, and light things bubble up to the top and heavy things sink down to the bottom. And inside the Earth, it's the heavy stuff, the iron and the nickel, that has sunk down to the center. The water, because it's so light, it bubbles up to the top, and all the water on the Earth is up near the surface or in the atmosphere. And it would be very, very difficult, probably impossible, for water to seep down that far.
We're going to Bill in West Hartford, Connecticut. Bill is an amateur astronomer, by the way, David. Bill, would you go to Mars one way?
Yes. Hi, George. Hi. First, let me say, yes, I would go to Mars one way if I could go with you and Richard C. Hoagland.
If I was stuck on Mars with you and Hoagland, I wouldn't go, but I'm kidding.
Doctor, yes. I am an amateur astronomer, and I'm a member of the Planetary Society, by the way, Bill Nye's
okay.
Planetary Society. And I have two great, great questions for you on Mars. The first one on the European Space Agency's trace gas orbiter that's orbiting Mars right now that's looking for methane. And the second question is on the two Mars rovers in 2020 that will be launched in 2020. Question number one, about the trace gas orbiter, and this was a question that Alan Stern, Dr. Alan Stern, did not answer a couple of weeks ago on Coast. The European Space Agency's TGO, Trace Gas Orbiter, will be able to detect methane. Will it be able to detect the kind of methane produced by biology, by life, which I think is carbon-12, if I'm not mistaken, as opposed to carbon-13 produced by geology? And second question is, in other words, will Trace Gas Orbiter maybe be the first spacecraft to give an indication of maybe life on Mars? Question number two, on the rovers in 2020, the European ExoMars rover and the American Curiosity 2.0 rover, 2020 rover, what do you think, if you can guess as of today, June 28, 2018, what discoveries do you think those two rovers will find?
Well, those are a lot of questions. Let me see if I even can remember all of them, but they're all really good questions. Biology produces methane. Biology doesn't care whether the carbon atom in a methane molecule is carbon-12 or carbon-13. Life will just take the carbon dioxide, for example, that plants breathe in, and some of that will become, you know, cows eat grass. The grass has both carbon-12 and carbon-13 and carbon-14 in it, and the methane that a cow produces by eating the grass will also have some carbon-12 and some carbon-13. So you can't distinguish between the different isotopic types of carbon in the methane molecule as being biological or non-biological. That wouldn't be a sufficient test. The only test would be how much methane is there, whether the methane that is in the atmosphere of Mars is more methane than could be produced by non-biological processes. So no, the carbon-13 won't help us. The trace gas orbiter, to my knowledge, has not produced any published measurements of methane. The Curiosity rover that is already on the surface of Mars has measured methane, and I think is a much better place for measuring the methane than a satellite that is in orbit looking down through the atmosphere. Curiosity is a dune buggy, effectively, with a little nose sniffing the gas a couple feet off the surface of Mars. That's where you want to be. You can make those measurements much more accurately if you're right there in place down near the surface of Mars. So I think the rovers are much better machines, much better laboratories for actually measuring the methane. And because the current Curiosity rover is already proving itself very good at making these measurements, I'm hopeful that the next generation rovers will be even better. The biggest problem that the Curiosity rover has with its methane measurements is that it's pretty certain that Curiosity brought some methane with it from Earth. And most of the methane that is inside the Curiosity rover when it makes methane measurements is actually methane from Florida, terrestrial methane. And they then have to distinguish between how much methane they brought with them and how much methane might be Martian methane. And that's very, very difficult. So hopefully the next generation of rovers will not have that problem, that they will have been able to get rid of the terrestrial methane before they make any Martian measurements.
David, we sure got our money's worth out of the rovers, didn't we?
We did, and the rovers are still going. Opportunity Rover is still going. Curiosity is still roving, and there's no end in sight, I think, for the measurements that the current Curiosity can make.
What do you think of the situation with Pluto? The New Horizons mission has sent us some incredible pictures. Yet Pluto's been downgraded.
The downgrading of Pluto was more political than scientific. Politics is in everything, including the business of astronomy. And I don't quite understand why some astronomers felt so passionate about demoting Pluto. But some astronomers, Alan Stern, who it sounds like was on your show a few weeks ago, among others, and I agree, don't think that ever should have been done.
Right,
a very, very small fraction of professional astronomers agree with that decision. A very, very small fraction of astronomers were actually at the International Astronomical Union meeting when that vote was taken. And I think it was a mistake. We really don't know how to define what a planet is in a way that can distinguish Pluto from Earth or Mars or Jupiter. In fact, if you took the Earth and put it in the part of the solar system where Pluto is, the current definition of a planet would tell you that the Earth is not a planet. And to me, that makes no sense. Location matters if you're trying to figure out where to site your next McDonald's franchise, but location shouldn't matter when deciding whether an object is a planet or is not a planet. So I have a problem with the definition that takes the Earth and moves it out to where Pluto is, and suddenly the Earth is not a planet anymore. It just makes no sense.
Well, and they made it sound like Pluto was like an asteroid, looking like almost a potato. And then when you look at these pictures from New Horizons, it's clearly a small planet. It's round, and it looks just like anything else in the solar system.
Yeah. And that's absolutely right. Pluto is a world in and of itself. It's got active surface processes and subsurface processes. It has an atmosphere that freezes onto the surface and then it goes back into the air above Pluto. It's got moons. It's got all the things we normally think of associating with planets. The parts of the definition that most astronomers find compelling for planets is that a planet is an object that orbits a star but is not itself another star. It's smaller than a star in orbit around a star. and it is big enough, massive enough, that gravity determines what its shape is. So if I took a paperclip and put it in orbit around the sun, most astronomers, not all, but most would say that paperclip is not a planet because its shape is determined by the atomic and molecular forces that hold the paperclip together. But a planet's shape is determined by the force of gravity, and the force of gravity makes it spherical, makes it round. And Pluto is a spherical object orbiting the sun. And by that, those criteria, Pluto should be a planet.
Let's go to Carl in Milwaukee on the wild card line. Carl, first of all, would you go to Mars one way?
You know, man is a social creature. And I think in the prison system, when you're in solitary confinement, that people go crazy.
Yep.
So I just don't see how a normal, sane person can go on a, you know, a couple of year hiatus by themselves.
I mean, would you go, though, if other people were with you, even though you weren't coming back?
You know, if I could go with a group of people who I cared about, who were like-minded, sure.
Interesting. Okay, go ahead with your question.
Well, I'm going to ask a question that I asked Carl Sagan about 200 years ago at a meet and greet at the Milwaukee Public Museum. And I was there. It was a stormy night, a pouring rain, hail, and there were a group of about 10 people that were at this thing with Carl Sagan. And suddenly I realized I was going to have an opportunity to actually speak with them. So this is a question I asked. When you think about astronomy, the universe, cosmology, and you're trying to come up with an idea or theory, which comes first? Is it the math or your imagination?
The math or my imagination? I would say what actually comes first is the data, the observations of the universe.
The science.
What we actually measure with our eyes, with our ears, with our fingers, what we can sense about the universe, you know, with our telescopes or anything else. So the data comes first, and the data has to drive our understanding. Now, beyond that, it's hard to distinguish between the math and the imagination. Math, we seem to have figured out over the last many hundreds of years that math is a great way to describe and understand the universe. But I think the ideas fundamentally come first. Math doesn't tell us that gravity exists. Our observations tell us that things fall down to the ground, and then our imagination comes up with this idea that there's something called a force that pulls things down to the ground, and then we make measurements and we discover that we can mathematize the measurements and come up with equations that describe what we do. So I think the data comes first, and then the ideas that come from our imagination, and then we use the math to get a better understanding of our ideas.
David, where do we get your book, Life on Mars?
You can, like everything else, you can buy it from Amazon and make Bezos richer. You can go to Princeton University Press and buy it from their website. Those are probably the best two sources. If you just Google Life on Mars on the internet, you'll probably find local bookstores that carry it as well.
Okay, we're going to come back and take final phone calls with David Weintraub in just a moment right here on Coast to Coast AM. Wow, our luncheon series is filling up July 10th here in Los Angeles with the mystic healer Sonia Grace, who will do individual readings of everybody who's there. I'll be there too, so come on out. Send an email to lunchwithgeorge@gmail.com to reserve your spot. Include your phone number. They'll get right back to you. It is Tuesday, July 10th. lunchwithgeorge@gmail.com. And we're back with our final segment with David Weintraub, his book, Life on Mars. David, why not the same kind of excitement about Venus as we have towards Mars?
Oh, Venus is a nasty place. Venus has a very, very thick atmosphere. That atmosphere has sulfuric acid, clouds, and rain in it. The greenhouse effect on Venus has raised the surface temperature to about 900 degrees. And the oceans that Venus once had, they did not sink into the planet. At those temperatures, they boiled off the planet and the water escaped to space. Venus is just a hellish place where life could not exist.
What about Europa, Jupiter's moon?
Europa is a fascinating place, and there is a tremendous amount of interest in Europa. Europa, as a moon of Jupiter, is heated by the tides from Jupiter, and as we were talking earlier about the insides of the Earth, the water on Europa has bubbled up to the surface, and the surface of Europa is water, but it's cold on the surface, so it's ice. But if you go beneath the ice, you go perhaps 10 miles deep into the ice, you get to a global layer of water. So Europa, beneath the surface, has an ocean of liquid water. And that water, obviously, since it's not ice, is warm. And you've got warm water, and you've got all the basic building blocks for life in that ocean. So a lot of astronomers desperately want to send missions back to Europa to study Europa to see whether those oceans below the surface might host life.
2001, A Space Odyssey, they told us to stay away from Europa.
Well, I think what we want to do is go to Europa. I don't think there are any obelisks there, but there are geysers erupting from the surface, water geysers, so the surface cracks and some of the water spurts out. And it is conceivable that if there is microscopic life in the subsurface oceans, that life could be detected in the geysers that are spurting out of the surface of Europa.
Okay, back to the phones we go. Joe, Long Island, New York. Joe, would you go to Mars and stay there?
I don't think anybody would. I think it's too big of a leap.
Actually, they've got volunteers already that say they will go one way.
Wow.
Ready to go.
Will they? You know, I'd act in a movie about Mars. I'd take a part in a movie with Matt Damon. But a couple of questions, Dave. One would be, I had this job at National Park where it was about 5,000-foot elevation for 4 months, and I came back here to Long Island, and for, I would say, upwards of 2 weeks, familiar stuff seemed unfamiliar. So I had a bizarre effect on my relationship to the environment, unexpected. And I'm wondering, like, the people in the space station, when they came back to Earth, did they have some sort of effect where what had been familiar seemed strangely unfamiliar? And my second question would be about, do we have the technology to, say, build in, say, the Sahara Desert, say, a shopping mall, which would kind of, like, test people's ability to acclimate into environments that were a little bit more outside of the norm? Would we have the capability, and would that help the space program? And also, this new plane that supposedly can fly 4,000 miles an hour that might come to market, will people actually get on a plane and sit in a seat where they're going 4,000 miles an hour?
Those are some great questions. The question about astronauts who have lived for as much as a year in space, when they come back down to Earth, they do have some problems. They can readjust, but they have problems. In a weightless environment, your bones start to lose calcium, you lose bone density, and the astronauts have to exercise very strenuously on the space station to try to keep their bones from deteriorating. Nevertheless, they can't be 100% effective at doing that. And living in that weightless environment for extended periods of time, when you come back down to the surface of the Earth and you're now subject to gravity, your body is certainly going to respond differently for a while. So astronauts who might go to Mars and would be in that weightless environment in a spacecraft for 6 months before they get to Mars, that's going to affect their bodies. And then if they were to go to the surface of Mars, where the gravity on the surface of Mars is about 40% as strong as the gravity on the surface of the Earth, they would have to adjust as well. You know, your blood pressure would have to adjust, the way fluids work inside your body would have to adjust because the gravity and the pressure is different. So we already know that happens to our astronauts, and certainly we'd have to learn to adapt to that if we went to Mars. As far as building habitats in the desert, NASA's already done that. NASA has built habitats in Arizona. They've built habitats in Hawaii, where they have put test subjects, volunteers, for extended periods of time, many months at a time, to find out whether they can live in environments which are as close to as possible, completely closed off from the environment. So all the air has to be reproduced and recirculated. The carbon dioxide has to be turned back into oxygen. They have to grow their own food. They have to get along with each other without any interaction from outside. And these are ways of testing a number of different problems that have to be solved if we were to go to Mars. One of them is just helping people learn how to live in extreme isolation and get along with the few people who exist in their community. One is learning how to make machines that can recycle everything in the environment. So NASA has invested significant funds in trying to figure out how to do that. How close those artificial habitats might be to life on Mars, I don't know. We don't know that much about exactly what the soil would be like on Mars for growing things, but we're working on that to try to grow things in Mars-like soil. So we're getting there. We're doing those experiments. As far as whether people would want to go in an airplane that can go 4,000 miles an hour, I have no idea. But
would you have G-forces on that, David?
What's that?
Would you have G-forces on something like that?
It depends on how quickly the airplane accelerated. You don't experience the G-forces when you're simply traveling at 4,000 miles an hour. If you're traveling at 4,000 miles an hour, your body doesn't know it's any different from not traveling at all.
Right, okay.
The difference, what your body experiences is the acceleration from zero to 4,000 miles an hour and the deceleration from 4,000 back to zero. And depending on how quickly that is, you would experience either large G-forces or small G-forces. If somebody wants paying customers to fly on that airplane, they better not experience G-forces. They better accelerate fairly slowly up to that high speed. And I don't know how it would work because at those speeds, you're breaking the sound barrier.
Yeah, that's right. Boeing announced a rendering yesterday of what they call their hypersonic jet, which will go from New York to London in 2 hours. That's fast.
That's very fast. And I can imagine getting from New York to London in 2 hours might be a wonderful step forward for traveling around the earth, both for tourism and for business. But that also may have some substantial negative effects on the environment to have something traveling that fast. Back when we used to have the Concorde flying from France to the United States, we had a lot of people really worried about the sonic booms from the Concorde. And as a result, it never was able to travel as fast or to as many places as people hoped it would. So it was a failure as an airplane.
Let's go to Annie in Alabama on the wild card line. Annie, would you take a one-way trip to Mars?
No, sir. I've got a mission here. I'd like to ask you, David, what would you think of my idea for a type of propulsion system which I believe might get us back from Mars? And since we made it back from the moon with conventional propulsion system, it seems that we could use a combination of just a solid rocket fuel for the liftoff only, that we could carry that. And then the rest of the way, why couldn't we use a combination of laser, solar sail, and solar electrical propulsion?
Undoubtedly, using different kinds of propulsion technologies is a good idea. But something like a solar sail pushes you away from the sun. I'm not sure how you would use a solar sail to lift you off of Mars. So I don't think that would work. All of your energy sources, all of your propulsion technologies require big energy sources. And getting off of Mars is much, much harder.
Yeah, you need conventional. To get off Mars, you still have to go conventional, don't you?
I think you probably do. The gravity is very strong. Even at only 40% of the Earth, it's very strong. The moon was 1/6 or 16% of the Earth's gravity. So it's 2.5 times harder to get off of Mars. And I think you just need a lot of fuel. And unless you can manufacture the fuel on Mars, you've got a problem, because we can't take the fuel with us. To take the fuel with us means having a fuel tank that the fuel doesn't leak out of, and we don't have that. And even if you had that, you'd have to launch a rocket from Earth with all that fuel on board, and that means you need an even bigger rocket to get the fuel off the Earth, and we don't have rockets big enough to do that.
And what about the habitats? How are you going to get habitats on Mars efficiently so they're working and not damaged, and then you want to make them modular so you can expand it? I mean, that's a lot.
I think what SpaceX is planning is a large number of unmanned BFR missions to Mars, in which they take as many modules as they need to take
and drop them
down to the surface.
And who's going to put them together and assemble them?
You got me for that one. One could imagine, if you're a science fiction writer, you could imagine that they could be reassembled robotically somehow with artificially intelligent rovers that landed on the surface and then move these things around and put them together. But we don't have the intelligent rover devices to do that.
Nah.
We're not there yet.
And they're not big enough. Jay in East Moline, Illinois, take it away. Jay, would you go to Mars one way?
If I was on a spaceship to Mars, George, you know what I'd be doing? I'd be constantly looking out the rearview mirror at that beautiful planet Earth, our home.
That you left.
I'd be thinking about our cornfields and oceans,
yeah,
and forests. Yeah. No, I wouldn't go.
I'm the same.
My thought is, it's, going to Mars, it's always been an intriguing idea. But I'd like to see the U.S. go back to the moon first, an actual, set up an actual functioning colony and learn how to function and survive there on a surface before we try to survive on Mars so far away. It's our nearest neighbor. It's less than 250,000 miles away, I believe. And then if there was a problem, maybe we could rescue the astronauts and learn from that.
What do you think of that, David? Go back to the moon and set something up there.
There are lots of advantages in going to the moon. Obviously, as you point out, it's much closer. The gravity is weaker, so getting down and then back up off the moon is much easier. We've already shown we know how to do that. The moon has some disadvantages. It has no atmosphere. It has no water. So Mars has some slight advantages over the moon, but I don't think they outweigh going to the moon. Going to the moon makes a lot of sense. We could go to the moon and we could establish manufacturing facilities in the low gravity of the moon. As an astronomer, the idea of putting big telescopes on the backside of the moon, where for part of the month every year it's completely shielded from sunlight, and you could build enormous telescopes on the moon, is very, very appealing. I think the reasons to go to the moon are very, very compelling, both economically and scientifically. But since we've been there and done that, I think the public in general is not enthusiastic about going to the moon. They want to do something we haven't done yet.
Yeah.
And going
to
Mars is something we haven't done yet.
Let's go to Christian in Alabama, first-time caller. Christian, would you go to Mars one way?
Well, that would depend on the circumstance. Probably not, but the chance to be able to build a society just intrigued me
a little bit.
But you had touched briefly on how to build a temporary atmosphere for somebody to live in. And I was wondering, with today's technology and our advances into AI and our robotics, what would be the chances we could put together a greenhouse on Mars to build that temporary atmosphere to sustain a human life?
Yeah, that could take 100 years, David. What do you think, to terraform Mars?
I think to build a greenhouse, to build an enclosed, relatively small environment on Mars in which we can increase the pressure so that you don't have to be in a spacesuit, so that we have oxygen to breathe, so you don't have to be in a spacesuit, I think we're probably fairly close to being able to do that, although I'm not sure we can still protect someone in that artificial environment from the dangerous radiation from space. But I think in a small enclosed habitat, it's almost like being inside the space station. We could make an enclosed habitat habitable temperature-wise, pressure-wise, oxygen-wise for colonists on Mars. But how big could that enclosed habitat be? I would imagine something like a dome that you might enclose a football field. We probably could do that. But bigger than that, I think, would be a stretch.
David, thank you for being on the program. Keep in touch with us on your next book, okay?
Okay. It's been a pleasure talking with you and with your guests tonight.
David Weintraub, the name of the book, Life on Mars. In a moment, psychic Joseph Jacobs joins us. We're going to talk with him a little bit about his earlier predictions, what he sees for the rest of 2018. And then in our final hour with Joseph, we'll take phone calls. He'll do readings tonight just for you.